Welcome to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters. Today's broadcast is an encore presentation of an interview with Dr. J. Richards, originally aired in 2009. The interview focuses on J.'s book, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem, as well as the economic and political climate back in 2009. We wanted to bring you this broadcast again because in light of the current economic situation, many of Dr. Richards' insights have proven to be prophetic. Does capitalism promote greed? Can a person follow Jesus' call to love others and also support capitalism? Was our recent economic crisis caused by flaws inherent to our free market system? Dr. Richards promotes a new approach to capitalism, revealing how it is fully consistent with Jesus' teachings and the Christian tradition, while also showing why this system is our best bet for renewed economic vigor. And now, here's Hank Hanegraaff.
I've mentioned this before on the broadcast, but I am utterly persuaded that the Bible teaches a form of Christian capitalism, in other words, responsibility associated with wealth. It doesn't promote the possession of money for the sake of money, but instead encourages us to use money for the sake of the kingdom. So a biblical view of wealth always involves an eternal perspective. It's also crucial to realize that the Bible clearly communicates the earth is the Lord's, everything in it, the world, all who live in it. Therefore, God is the landlord. We are just tenants. We didn't arrive with anything, and we're not going to take anything with us when we leave. If we just remember that fact, it'll save us a world of hurt. Poverty doesn't equal piety, nor do, on the other hand, riches equal righteousness. God prospers some more than others. He takes some and puts them in humble conditions and others in more wealthy conditions. And if there was a one-to-one ratio between godliness and wealth, and of course the godliest people in the world would be the wealthiest, but if you check the Forbes 500, you will quickly dash that illusion. It's important to view wealth with eternity in mind. Lead your life here below as a responsible steward, whether you have a little or a lot, because one day in the judgment, God Himself will richly reward you. It's your bank statement in heaven that counts. If you fix your hope on the one you have down here, you are bankrupt no matter how many digits you count next to your name. But you're also bankrupt if you don't understand economic systems. Because if you don't understand economic systems, you can so often fall for the skin of the truth stuffed with a great big lie. We hear today that socialism is Christian. Capitalism is anti-Christian. We're talking in our economy today about redistribution of wealth. It all sounds grand and glorious. You can go to Christian bookstores today and pick up books by Christian authors that talk about redistribution of wealth and that underscore the notion that the great crisis in America is division of wealth. In other words, you have a few people with a lot of wealth, a lot of people with a little wealth, and that's the great crisis. And therefore, we have to tax the wealthy in a disproportionate manner so that we finally have the equality that we find in the Bible. But do we really? Is the Bible really about socialism? We're going to discuss all of that and more on today's edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with my guest, Dr. J. Richards, and his book, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Hank.
I want to ask you the quintessential question, I suppose, a lot of people may be asking in their minds, wasn't the early Christian church socialist? And if they were socialist, why should we embrace capitalism?
I am so glad you asked that question. It's exactly what Christians that know the Bible often ask. And you're thinking of the early chapters of the book of Acts, in which the church in Jerusalem, after Pentecost, the Bible says, sold their goods as individuals and held their possessions in common. That looks like, superficially, a version of communism. You think of communism as sort of living as a commune in which people don't have private property, they hold their possessions in common. Now, that's, like I said, that looks like that if you look at it superficially, but I think it's all the difference in the world between what happened in the early church and communism. First, notice that this is a restricted example. We're never told that this is normative for all the churches. So far as we know, the other churches in the other cities, like Antioch, didn't exist in this way. Secondly, remember the church in Jerusalem was under an unusual circumstance. You had Pentecost, in which thousands of Jews had come all around from around the known world. They'd become Christians. They didn't have any place to stay. You know, they're sort of in a temporary situation, and the Bible says that the Spirit moved the church at that time to do this. But notice that they did it voluntarily. I think that's the sort of crucial point. A group of individuals deciding to sell their possessions and to hold their possessions in common is completely different from the economic system of communism. In communism, you have the state, that is the government, coercively confiscating the wealth of people and then redistributing it according to their lights. That's not cooperation. That's coercion. Those are entirely different things. This is so important that even Christian scholars like Ron Sider, whom I very much disagree with on a lot of economic issues, knows this is different. He said, look, this is not communism because it was voluntary. If that was a justification for communism, you could use the family as a justification for communism. You know, my wife and I and my daughters, we hold our possessions in common. But, of course, it's voluntary, and the family is not, the economic system is not the state. That's the crucial thing to hold in common. This voluntary holding of possessions that the Church of Jerusalem had was never held up as a universal prescription for the church, and it certainly was never used as justification for a government coercively confiscating the private property of others.
A lot of people in America right now are flat scared. As Christians, we don't need to be scared. We know who holds the future, but we should be informed. We hear about cap and trade and universal health care, and we right. wonder what that's going to do to our economy. Let's start with the first cap and trade. Is this a good idea or a bad idea?
It's a terrible idea, and I say that without qualification. In fact, I think the cap and trade bill that recently passed Congress is being considered in the Senate. It's one of the worst pieces of legislation, certainly in my lifetime. I mean, this is essentially a tax on all forms of energy. The purpose is to increase the cost of energy for every American. It's not just that that'll be one of the consequences. That's actually its purpose, is to increase the cost of energy, because a large amount of our energy, of course, comes from fossil fuels, which release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Now, let's set aside the whole global warming question and what CO2 is doing and all those sorts of things. Just look at the economic policy. We know, because European countries have tried these cap-and-trade policies, that, first of all, they don't work. They drive up the cost of energy because they basically say how much initially the country as a whole can emit in terms of carbon dioxide, which is directly related to our energy consumption. What that means is the government's going to basically assign individuals and communities and companies carbon credits. Like, they're going to say, you're going to be able to release this much carbon. If you emit more than that, you're going to have to pay a heavy tax. If you emit less than that, you can at least trade it. So because you can trade these so-called carbon credits, people say it's a market-oriented approach, but it's a fake market that's actually quite coercive. Whenever you restrict the amount of energy that we can use in this way, you inevitably drive up the cost of energy, and everything involves energy costs. And so what that means is the cost of absolutely everything is going to go up. This is the very last thing you'd want to do to the economy, certainly during an economic recession that we're having. It also gives the federal government huge amounts of power to control the lives and, frankly, destinies of every American and every company. Finally, we know that these policies never work. They have not led to a net reduction in the emissions of carbon dioxide in European countries that have tried this. It just changes people's behavior. So it preferentially selects for foreign producers of certain kinds of fuel. So if a company in the United States is going to be punished for emitting CO2, then it favors foreign companies that are doing it that aren't subject to the tax. And so it creates all sorts of weird economic incentives and disincentives that not only raise the cost of everything, but they finally don't even work in what they're supposed to do.
We're a discernment ministry. We're about teaching people discernment skills. One of the things you touch on in the book is global warming.
Right.
And one of your purposes in mentioning it is you want to teach Christians discernment skills with respect to global warming. They hear the propaganda. How are they able to cut through the fog and get to the root of the issue?
Well, the crucial point to remember is that global warming is a cluster of different issues, and you got to consider them separately. So the first question everybody should ask is the global warming, that is, over time, is there this average increase in temperature in the last 100 or 150 years? Now, you can answer that question yes or no. I think the evidence is pretty good that we're in a slight warming trend since about 1870. But notice that's different from this other question about what's causing the warming, and that's where all the controversy is. Even if the globe is in a warming trend, that doesn't tell us if human beings are the main cause of it, you know, from emitting CO2. That's an entirely different question. You got to look at the evidence for that on its own, apart from evidence of warming. So you look at polar ice caps, let's say they're shrinking over time. That might be evidence of a warming trend. It doesn't tell us if we cause it. The third question, so you ask, is it warming? Are we causing it? Third question, is it bad? And this is the thing nobody asks, at least in the mainstream media, but it's the relevant question. Just because there's a warming trend doesn't tell you if that's going to be bad on balance. You have to weigh the costs and the benefits. You know, warming might lead to droughts in one place, but to a longer, wetter, warmer growing season in other places. We know that moderate warming in the past, you know, say 1,000 years during the so-called medieval warming period was a good thing. Europe was much more productive in its agriculture. Greenland was settled by the Vikings and all these sorts of things. So even if we're causing warming, it's happening. That doesn't tell you if it's good or bad. You'd have to know what the optimum global temperature is to determine if we're moving toward it or away from it to answer that question. Then there's the final, just prudential question of policy. Is any particular policy, the so-called Kyoto Protocol or the cap-and-trade policy we're talking about now in the United States, would it make any difference in any case? Even if there's global warming and we're causing it and it's bad, would the policy actually affect it? We know from experience with Europe and just from analysis of the current cap-and-trade policy that it would do virtually nothing, even assuming the truth of the basic global warming claims. And that's the reason I think, quite apart from the bad economic consequences, that nobody should support the cap-and-trade policy.
Let's look at this from the standpoint of the poor and the downtrodden that as Christians we are to care for. If we follow a pipe dream, if we follow global warming, and many Christian evangelicals are committed in signature to do that,
That's right. If we
do that, how will it affect the poor in countries around the world, much less in the United States, when we spend trillions of dollars on something that's a fantasy, when we could be spending billions of dollars on real problems that really meet the needs of the poor?
That's the crucial question. I think that's kind of the most important economic question we have to ask. What are the consequences of a policy? And based on the cost, is there some way we could have spent the money better? We know that any policy to restrict CO2, so let's talk about cap and trade, it increases the cost of energy. Now, that's not that big a deal, frankly, to me. I'm in an income bracket, you know, sort of upper middle class American, like millions of people. So the amount of money I spend on, heating for my house and gasoline, it's not a huge percentage of my budget. But if you're right at the margins, you're right on the poverty line, your energy costs are a very significant part of your budget. What that means is a slight tweak, a slight increase in the cost of energy can make the difference between, you know, just living on the edge and completely going under. Now, people usually don't starve to death and freeze to death in the United States, but that's exactly what happens in a lot of places in the third world. Policies that we enact in the United States that restrict the free flow of sources of energy, that increase the cost of energy worldwide, will directly impact the world's poor most disproportionately, and in fact will lead, I think we can say quite confidently, to the deaths of many people. So these things, these aren't just sort of academic questions that we ask about various economic policies. They actually have real-world consequences. If we're concerned about the poor and the downtrodden, we simply have to follow this evidence and to see what the consequences are.
Talking to Dr. Jay Richards, and on the other side of the break, my first question is universal health care. I mentioned this in yesterday's broadcast, but in 1918, Vladimir Lenin introduced a cradle-to-grave health care system that utterly bankrupted the Soviet economy. What's going to happen in America? Are we going to relive history? What can we expect in the future? Jay's not a prophet, but we're going to be discussing all of that and more on the other side of the break. His book, it's a must read, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem, available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. Check it out at equip.org on the World Wide Web, or simply write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also talk to our resource consultants at 888-7000-CRI. And do remember, this is a ministry supported by people just like you. Without your support, we don't stay on the air. So please be generous as you write me, call me, or contact me on the World Wide Web at equip.org. We'll be right back in just a moment with Dr. Jay Richards.
Christians have long employed spiritual resources like hard work and creativity to create wealth and alleviate poverty. Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem by Dr. Jay Richards exposes 8 myths about capitalism, including the notion that capitalism is based on greed and the idea that if someone becomes rich, it means someone else will automatically become poor, and demonstrates that a good Christian can be a good capitalist. To order Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem, call 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to our secure website at www.equip.org. When you visit equip.org, you'll find links that will instantly connect you with the latest that the Christian Research Institute has to offer. Looking for books and materials you hear about on the broadcast? Check out our convenient e-store. Connect with CRI on Facebook and Twitter. You can also listen to current and past Bible Answer Man broadcast. All this and more when you go to equip.org. Once again, the address is equip.org. But don't touch that dial. Hank will be right back after this short break. Attacks against the Bible's authenticity are everywhere in today's culture. So take the key proofs of scriptural authority with you wherever you go. Hank Hanegraaff's flip chart, MAPS, Memorable Keys to the Bible's Divine Inspiration, condenses the proof points from his landmark book, Has God Spoken?, in a convenient pocket size, printed on heavy laminated paper for years of use. Good for refreshing your own memory or sharing with skeptics and seekers, the flip chart is our gift to you when you support the Bible Answer Man broadcast today. The Christian Research Institute's vital outreach is entirely supported by God's provision through friends like you, so your gift helps bring you more of the answers you need. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org today to give and request your copy of MAPS, Memorable Keys to the Bible's Divine Inspiration.
Believe it or not, even Santa can be saved. Far from being a dangerous fairy tale, Santa Claus, in reality, is an anglicized form of the Dutch name Sinterklaas, which in turn is a reference to St. Nicholas, a Christian bishop from the 4th century. According to tradition, St. Nick not only lavished gifts on needy children, but also valiantly supported the doctrine of the Trinity at the Council of Nicaea in AD 325.
Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by Hank Hanegraaff, with accompanying Christmas Carol CD for a gift to CRI when you call 888-7000-274 or online at www.equip.org. Don't forget to inquire about the personalized edition or The Heart of Christmas audiobook, instrumental Christmas CD, or quantity discount options. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching graphics with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what you'll find in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Should Christians attend same-sex weddings? Would saying yes signal an endorsement? Would saying no signal a lack of commitment to the loved one? There are no easy answers. Other topics include confronting the apologetic challenges of a secular culture, reflections on the girl with the dragon tattoo, sci-fi, free will, and the problem of evil, Muhammad and the Messiah, comparing the central figures of Islam and Christianity, what has poetry to do with evangelism, robbing Paul to pay Peter and James, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Many Christian leaders are praising money, greed, and God, why capitalism is the solution and not the problem. Marvin Olasky writes, Dr. J. Richards annihilates the economic myths taught as facts in schools and magazines. This is an excellent book for all of us who have been subjected to years of propaganda. To order Money, Greed, and God, call the Christian Research Institute at 888-7000-274. Or order online at www.equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip 28271. Well, now here's Bible Answer Man host, Hank Hanegraaff.
And I'm with Dr. J. Richards. He's the author of Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem, a book that you absolutely have to have in your library. If you loved Privileged Planet, you're going to be absolutely captivated by this book. Order today on the World Wide Web at equip.org via the mail at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Or when you talk to our resource consultants at 888-7000-CRI. Jay, we talked about cap and trade in the last segment, and you were sort of ambivalent. You really didn't come out and say whether you liked it or not.
Yeah.
No, recap that for us. You said this is the worst idea in your lifetime or something like that?
I'm happy to be on the record on this. I think it's the worst piece of legislation that the Congress has passed in my lifetime, followed a close second, unfortunately, by this other thing that's being discussed. We have two, in my view, very, very flawed pieces of legislation. One has passed the House, the cap and trade, and one is still being discussed, and it's the national health care plan.
Yeah, and I did mention this yesterday. Here we have, from a historical standpoint, something to go back to. Is there any validity in talking about 1918 and Vladimir Lenin's cradle-to-grave health care system, which bankrupted the Russian economy?
Well, I think it certainly teaches us the basic economic lessons, the basic effects of certain policies. I mean, certainly people say, okay, look, we're not dealing with the Bolshevik Revolution. You know, we don't have people getting killed in the streets. Yeah, of course. We're not dealing with Marxist socialism here. It's not revolutionary. But I do think we're dealing with a version, a sophisticated 21st century version of incremental socialism, a popular leader, very popular leader that's fortunately supported by a Congress that are passing policies in which the state is confiscating more and more of the private economy. So we have the auto industry, we have the banking and insurance industry. Now we're talking about the healthcare system. Now, you say, even to use the word system implies it's just one thing. But what we're talking about is about 16%, going on 17% of the American economy, and it involves all of the most intimate and private decisions that we make having to do with our health care. Has obviously a crucial part to play in our quality of life. That part of the economy is now being discussed in the halls of Congress, and Congress is frankly considering whether it's going to take it under its wing and eventually control that part of the economy.
You have lectured U.S. congressmen on economic myths. Don't they get the problem? Don't they understand what's wrong with cap and trade, with universal health care?
I hope so. I mean, I put it differently. Either they get it and they're misrepresenting that, or they simply don't understand it. I mean, we have to sort of look at history, and there have been a lot of really smart people, a lot of smart, well-intentioned people that don't understand sort of basic economic facts. I don't know why that is, because this stuff, it's not rocket science. We're not doing vector calculus here. But the problem is that there's strong political and personal motivations not to understand economics. That's what some famous economists have said in the past. You know, economics, unlike physics or chemistry, there aren't sort of strong political reasons not to understand chemistry. But when it comes to economics, you know, and you're a legislator, if you really understand economics, you realize that the power of the state is quite limited in what it can do. The state can't dictate what the price of gasoline is going to be or is supposed to be. That's determined by supply and demand in the real world, and the government can't dictate what that reality is. And so I think there's kind of an intrinsic temptation for people that are in politics to misunderstand economics, precisely because if they understand it, they realize how limited their power is. Then you have what I think are very well-intentioned people. I don't think the average congressman in the U.S. Congress is saying, how can I get more power? He's probably thinking, how can I serve my country? How can I help people? How can I help my constituents, at the very least? But you combine that sort of passion, some misguided, some I think appropriate, with a misunderstanding of economics, you end up with very, very bad policies.
That's one of the things you discuss in the book under the piety myth, that good intentions simply aren't good enough.
No, they're not. And that's, I would say that as Christians, we're actually morally self-indulgent when we focus on our intentions in this area. I mean, obviously, my intentions are relevant in my state before God. So not just what I do, but why I do them. God is concerned about that, and my spiritual state hinges on that. But when it comes to economics, when it comes to policy, only the consequences of those policies matter. It doesn't matter why a congressman wants to have wage and price controls. They're going to have the same effect whether he has good or bad intentions, and that's what's crucial. So I say when we're dealing with policies, when we're dealing in the economic realm, we should really just ignore our intentions and look at the consequences. Of course, if we're Christians, we want to help poor people. Of course, we want to alleviate poverty and disease and all these things. The question is, how best do you do that in the real world?
How likely is cap and trade and universal health care to become the rule of the land?
Well, I would downgrade the likelihood of both of these for several reasons. The word on the health care plan is actually getting out. It was really a blessing to have the Congressional Budget Office come out and contradict the White House in the White House's estimates. Now, the White House claims that we're going to add millions of people to the federal rolls. We're going to provide health care that's presumably not being provided previously, and yet it's not going to add to the deficit. Now, this is the sort of thing that on the face of it seems almost impossible to believe, but then when you have the Congressional Budget Office say, well, we've done the calculations, no, sorry, it's going to add at least $1 trillion to the budget deficit. I mean, this is the Congressional Budget Office, which you would expect at this point to be a political body, nevertheless coming out and saying, look, it's not adding up. And so I don't think it's a politically winning strategy to just keep saying this isn't going to add to the deficit, and we're looking at these town halls around the country that are taking place. So I'm modestly optimistic that this plan, at least in its current incarnation, is not going to happen, but I would be very surprised if we didn't have to keep dealing with this for the next 4 or 8 years. I think the same thing is probably going to be true about cap and trade. I think there are a number of Congress people that voted for the policy because they knew it would probably meet some snags in the U.S. Senate. Remember, even in the 1990s when President Clinton was in the White House, many Democrats in Congress, we still didn't pass the Kyoto Protocol in the Senate, which would have led to us restricting our emissions and energy use, because Congress at that point knew this is going to be really bad for the economy. It's not going to do anything to help the environment. I assume that many senators understand that as well about cap and trade. So I'm hoping that the thing will finally get bogged down in legislative procedure and it will never see the light of day. But we need to keep fighting, I think, to make sure that happens.
Let's be candid and talk about Barack Obama for just a moment. Doesn't he know what you know with respect to economics?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the truth of the matter is that I didn't understand a lot of this stuff. I mean, I had advanced graduate degrees, but they weren't in economics, and still was sort of mixed up about these things. And so I hope that actually there's just simple misunderstanding, because the alternative would be that President Obama and others understand these things and nevertheless are violating them. It just seems strange to me that someone would advocate an economic policy that they know in the end is going to fail. Now, saying that, we have to realize that when it comes to health care, we actually have a historical precedent on this. We know it has bad economic effects, but no country, unless that country has collapsed like the Soviet Union, ever kind of backs out of universal health care once it's implemented. That's the irony of it. So Great Britain implemented socialized health care. You had a conservative government under Margaret Thatcher. She was still not able to roll back universal health care. And the reason is that every American citizen becomes dependent on the government. We are all end up on the federal dole. And once you got that, it's very difficult to reverse it. And that's why I think it's so dangerous. If we could get a different government in a few years and reverse the policy, that'd be one thing. But there's something about the kind of internal logic of everyone being dependent upon the government for their health care that makes it very difficult to undo once it happens.
We're not into conspiracy theories, but there are a lot of people out there that I talk to that are overtly saying, I'm worried that the government really wants the devolution of society, then we'll really have a level playing field and redistribution of wealth.
Well, I do think there's some people that think that. There's definitely some people way over on the environmental left that actually would like to see the collapse of society. Fortunately, I don't think that attitude is part of the mainstream, and so I don't think there's a conspiracy here. What I would call it is a conspiracy of consensus. You have a whole lot of people in power, and they all think alike. And when they all think alike and have the same basic political and economic worldview, there doesn't need to be a conspiracy. They don't need to get their marching orders because they're going to end up voting for the same bills and advocating the same policies. You don't need a secret leader to do that. You just need agreement on the basic ideas.
We're talking to Dr. Jay Richards. The book is a must-read, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. In the book, Jay argues the problem by exposing all kinds of myths that we have about capitalism. What is capitalism? What is socialism? What is not? What are the myths that we often buy into uncritically with respect to economics? It's a must-read, Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. It's available right now through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute, and you can order on the World Wide Web at equip.org via the mail at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also talk to our resource consultants at 888-7000-CRI. On the other side of the break, I want to talk to Dr. Jay Richards about what the likelihood is for our economy as we move forward in the next few months and years. I want to get his perspective and pass that along to you. Also want to talk about the materialist myth. You'll be interested in this because a lot of people believe that wealth is merely material property. Is it really, or is wealth something else? We'll talk about all of that and more on the other side of the break. And do remember that this is a ministry supported by listeners just like you. Without you, we simply do not stay on the air. Chris in Sacramento, California writes, I have answers now for my faith, and I can give others a reasoned response to the questions they have for me. That's the point of the Christian Research Institute. And he also goes on to say that his brother-in-law is no longer a Mormon, all because of a ministry that's making a difference while there's yet time. We'll be right back with Dr. J.
The church is bombarded with two competing myths about money and capitalism. First, that wealth is bad and causes much of the world's suffering, or that wealth is good and God wants you to prosper and be rich. Dr. Jay Richards exposes these myths and other common misconceptions about capitalism and reveals the surprising ways that capitalism is, in fact, the best system to respond to the biblical mandate of alleviating poverty and protecting the environment.
The truth of the matter is that capitalism, if you look at its reality, there's been no economic system, in fact, nothing in human history that's created more wealth, that's raised more people out of poverty, that's increased not only per capita income but life expectancy than capitalism. But it gets all the bad advertising. And unfortunately, with a lot of Christians, as you mentioned, their intentions are often very good. I mean, we're called to be concerned about the poor. We're called to be good stewards of the environment. I completely agree with that. In fact, I think it's a mistake when Christians act like those aren't important priorities. The question is, how best do you help the poor? And if you're going to talk about things like poverty, you got to know something about economics. And the problem is you hear economics, and I've known this. I mention the word to people sometimes, and they just remember their macroeconomics textbook from college and think, oh, here we go. The truth of the matter is economics is basically thinking really hard about the consequences of various policies, including the unintended consequences. And if you do that, and don't just sort of focus on your good intentions. Turns out that free market capitalism is by far the best system when you can have it for creating wealth and alleviating poverty. It just doesn't have any real world alternatives.
To order your copy of Money, Greed, and God, call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-274. Or online 24 hours a day at www.equip.org. That's equip.org. Hank Hanegraaff and Jay Richards will return right after this.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching graphics with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what you'll find in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. The greatest apologetic for Christianity is its founder. All that the Lord Jesus was, said, and did. A natural avenue for Christian apologetics to Muslims, then, is to contrast the words and works of Jesus and Muhammad. Other topics include, did Daniel accurately predict a succession of nations? Sci-fi, free will, and the problem of evil. What has poetry to do with evangelism? A summary critique, Lawrence M. Krauss's A Universe from Nothing, Arthur Goldwag's The New Hate, John Gribben's Alone in the Universe, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org.
To fully grasp the significance of Christ's messianic role, you must drink deeply from the wellspring of Old Testament prophecy. In Hebrews, as in the rest of the New Testament, the Old Testament history of Israel is interpreted as a succession of types that find ultimate fulfillment in the birth, death, resurrection, and ascension of the Christ we celebrate at Christmas.
Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by Hank Hanegraaff with accompanying Christmas Carol CD for a gift to CRI when you call 888-7000-274 or online at www.equip.org. Don't forget to inquire about the personalized edition or The Heart of Christmas audiobook, instrumental Christmas CD, or quantity discount options.
Attacks against the Bible's authenticity are everywhere in today's culture, so take the key proofs of scriptural authority with you wherever you go. Hank Hanegraaff's flip chart, Maps, Memorable Keys to the Bible's Divine Inspiration, condenses the proof points from his landmark book, Has God Spoken?, in a convenient pocket size, printed on heavy laminated paper for years of use. Good for refreshing your own memory or sharing with skeptics and seekers, the flip chart is our gift to you when you support the Bible Answer Man broadcast today. The Christian Research Institute's vital outreach is entirely supported by God's provision through friends like you, so your gift helps bring you more of the answers you need. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org today to give and request your copy of MAPS, Memorable Keys to the Bible's Divine Inspiration.
Christians have long employed spiritual resources like hard work and creativity to create wealth and alleviate poverty. Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem by Dr. Jay Richards exposes 8 myths about capitalism, including the notion that capitalism is based on greed and the idea that if someone becomes rich, it means someone else will automatically become poor, and demonstrates that a good Christian can be a good capitalist.
The reality is, it's not like there's this fixed amount of wealth, like this pot of gold that's already out there, and some people just got more than their fair share. The reality is that human beings, in market economies at least, create wealth that wasn't there before. They create a good or service or technology that was not there before, so that you end up with more wealth. So the problem is not that there's a gap between the richest people in the world, who in market economies are the most productive people in the world. The problem is that there's a lot of poor people. So rather than saying, oh gosh, what can we do to narrow this gap? We ought to be saying, what can we do or what can be done so that many, many people in the world that aren't able to produce wealth are able to produce wealth? That's the real moral question.
To order Money, Greed, and God, call 888-7000-CRI or go online to our secure website 24 hours a day at www.equip.org. And now, with his guest, Dr. Jay Richards, here's Hank Hanegraaff.
We're hearing it from the pulpit that the best years of America lay ahead. We're at the vanguard of one of the greatest revivals in the history of Christianity, in the history of any nation. It's going to be a revival in which people walk out of hospitals healed, in which we're no longer going to have people in sports arenas because they're going to be following the prophets. And so in the Christian community, we're listening to the voices of prophets that are telling us that we are going to have utopia ahead. We're hearing the same thing from politicians. My question, Jay Richards, is while we have a resilient planet, and you've talked about that in your books and in your lectures,
right?
Do we have a resilient economy? Is it possible that we could have a collapse?
It is possible that we could have a collapse. I would never be the one to predict that, because I think you always have competing factors. I mean, the truth of the matter is I'm as pessimistic right now about the at least near-term economic future of the United States as I've ever been. It's primarily because of this unprecedented spending and borrowing. I mean, there just simply is a limit to the amount of money that a government can borrow before it creates hyperinflation and collapses. We know that, we don't know exactly what dollar number that is, but we know at some point there's a limit, and that the basic trust that's required for economic stability just simply collapses. It's like a cascade or a tipping point. Now, where that is, we don't know. That's what I'm worried about if we don't reverse course, certainly with the borrowing and the spending. On the other hand, we've seen historically, especially in market economies and in the United States, all manner of human ingenuity and creativity and invention. You know, I quote the director of the U.S. Patent Office in 1899, who said all the inventions that had been invented had been invented. So there's basically nothing left to be invented. Well, we know 100 years later, orders of magnitude more patents are issued now every year than they were 100 years ago. So you can't ever predict what's going to be invented or created tomorrow. That's the essence of human creativity. So I think we're sort of in a race between highly destructive economic policy that simply can't continue for very long, but it continues to be in a race against this competing tendency, which is humans to create things that we hadn't anticipated and to create new wealth. And so I think both futures are possible, but a lot of this, I frankly think, is going to be decided in the next few years.
What about the talk about a recovery right around the corner and the euphoria in the stock market right now?
Well, I mean, this is the problem, is that economic policies in which the government borrows large amounts of money from basically from the future and puts it into the current economy, it's possible that could have a near-term economic benefit. So it looks like something that's going to help long-term. The problem is that there's a cost to be paid, and the cost ends up being much greater than the current benefit. Now, I frankly don't think the so-called stimulus is doing anything in particular in the economy. We know historically that the American economy always seems to come around either within a couple of years or at the most within 10 years in the case of the Great Depression. The economy fundamentally is sound because we still do basically have the rule of law. We have a productive population, a fairly well-educated population. All those things are there. But we also know that policy matters and that there is a limit to the degree to which the government can borrow money and then try to sort of force it into the economy. The money has to be taken from somewhere. We're already seeing foreign governments that often buy our treasury bonds or are not buying them at the interest rates they previously bought them. So the Fed has to raise the interest rate to sell them. That's going to have an effect on interest rates across the board. All these things have an effect. World finance does get complicated pretty quickly. It's more complicated than the basic principles of economics I talk about in the book, but they're also fairly well understood, and everybody knows that over time you can't just keep spending more money than you bring in, and that's as true of a family as it is of the federal government.
In Money, Greed, and God, you argue that the problems Christians have with capitalism usually derive from believing 8 myths about capitalism. Let's talk quickly about just a couple of those myths. The Nirvana myth.
The Nirvana myth is basically the idea of comparing capitalism not to the real-world alternatives, so not to democratic socialism and communism and things like that, but comparing it to Nirvana or comparing it to the kingdom of God. I use the word Nirvana just so people won't think it's kind of a uniquely Christian idea. It's basically the utopian idea in which you compare capitalism not to those other things that we could actually have, but to a utopia that we can't possibly implement. In fact, when we try to implement utopia, as the communists did, we end up with hell on earth rather than heaven on earth. But if you take capitalism and you compare it to the live alternatives, it's far more just, far more equitable, far more wealth-producing and poverty-alleviating than any of the real-world economic alternatives. Of course, if you compare real-world capitalism to the kingdom of God, it's not going to look very good. But that's not the relevant comparison. We want to know what kind of economic system, short of the kingdom of God, is the best one overall. And if you ask the question that way and don't commit the Nirvana myth, capitalism wins hands down.
Supposedly, Ronald Reagan once said, and you quote him in your book, socialism only works in heaven where they don't need it, and in hell where they already have it.
That's exactly right.
The materialist myth, the idea that wealth is merely transferred from one party to another like some material entity. And before you actually talk about that myth, talk about what wealth is. So many people think that it is these tangible assets,
right,
as opposed to productivity.
That's what it is. I mean, it's productivity, or you can even think of it, it's sort of a means. It's a means to achieving some particular end. And so wealth is often sort of, you could think of it as congealed in a material thing. It might be contained, as it were, in money, in a free system of exchange. But money itself is actually just a system of social agreements in which people trust the economic system, and they trust that if they're paid for their product with money, that they'll be themselves able to use that same paper to buy the things that they need. So notice it's a system of trust, so that it might look like it's this material thing, but it's actually something, you know, spiritual or social. And in the same way, you could think of, you know, people say, okay, well, what about land? I mean, land is obviously a material thing, and land is a form of wealth. Well, yeah, that's right. But notice that land, per se, isn't property by itself. You know, a person can be on a plot of land, but if there's no title for it, if there's no general agreement that the land belongs to someone, so that their neighbors have to abide by that agreement, the state has to abide by it, the state will defend the boundaries, then the land isn't actually property. But if you have a system of laws in which the person has a title, so the land has boundaries, it can be used as collateral on a loan, suddenly the land, the material thing, becomes property, and then it becomes wealth in a substantially different sense. And so that's why in the West we have such great capacity for creating wealth, whereas you can have large tracts of land, of course, and natural resources in the third world, but they don't have that representational system of property and titling, and they can't create wealth in large amounts. And so I think that the nature of wealth is far more immaterial and even, you know, I might say spiritual, than it is material. Or it's something about the way in which human beings, as strange material and spiritual hybrids, interact with the material world. But if you think of wealth as just matter, and I call that the materialist myth, then you think, okay, well, there's going to be some fixed amount of it. It's like a pot of gold, and somebody gets to the pot of gold first, they can get more than their fair share. Anytime somebody says that, if you're in a free economy and some politician points to a rich guy and says, well, he's taken more than his fair share, you ought to ask, well, did he steal his wealth from someone, or did he make it by creating a product that people wanted to buy? That's the crucial distinction, because the reality is that wealth isn't just transferred like a pot of gold. Wealth is created. So, you know, again, if you think of wealth as like a pie has a fixed size, and so all you can do is slice it up into equal slices. That means if somebody gets too big a slice, somebody else gets a smaller slice. So then you could imagine the government should take all that wealth and redistribute it. In reality, though, wealth is not like a pie, or if it's like a pie, the pie grows over time so that somebody could get a large slice. But that doesn't mean they took the slice from someone else. They may have actually created it. And this is the sort of thing that ought to be intuitively obvious, frankly, to Christians. Economists notice it all the time. This is why you have economies that grow. And nevertheless, Christians, the last people that ought to commit the materialist myth, unfortunately do it all the time, and as a result, we make all sorts of unfortunate mistakes in economics.
You're obviously passionate about your book. I want you to talk to our audience for just a moment and tell them why it's important for them to be informed on capitalism.
It's important for Christians because we are called to be stewards of the world that God has created. economics, you could think of economics as sort of the science or the intellectual discipline that teaches us how to be the stewards of limited resources. There's always going to be scarcity of something short of the kingdom of God. If you don't have scarcity, of course, you don't have to have economics. But if you have a scarcity of food or of electricity or energy or whatever, what have you, you want to say, how do we exercise our stewardship most effectively? That's what economics does. It says, here's the way to use these resources in the ways that they're most valued. That, so economics applied properly is actually kind of the way in which I think we apply in the real world the exercise of our stewardship, at least insofar as it has to do with the economy. Economics describes the basic realities that God has created. Just as there are laws of physics, there are laws of chemistry, so there are laws, if you will, of economics. There's just things about the world that God has created that we've discovered. A lot of these we discovered in spades in the 20th century with the experiments doing capitalism and socialism. So these are things that we know and we ought to take account of if we're going to exercise our stewardship both over the created material world and also over our fellow human beings that we're responsible for. We simply have to be informed about some of these basic principles of economics. They're not the sort of things you have to have a graduate degree to understand, but you have to spend some time, frankly, just thinking clearly about the consequences of policy, and that's why I wrote the book.
There are a cacophony of voices out there, and it's so often difficult to know who to trust and what to believe. This is a book you can trust in. It's titled Money, Greed, and God, Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem. It's so important for you to read this book in the midst of an economic crisis because it will inform you so that you can be a proper steward of the resources God has entrusted you with. The book is available to the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can order on the World Wide Web at equip.org via the mail at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271, or when you talk to our resource consultants at 888-7000-CRI. Jay, as always, great to have you on the broadcast.
Great to be with you, Hank. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Bless you, my friend. And again, the book available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. Order today. It will make a difference for time and for eternity. Out of time for this edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Looking forward to seeing you next time with more of the show.
We'd like to thank Dr. Jay Richards for joining us on today's Bible Answer Man program. The church is bombarded with two competing messages about money and capitalism. First, that wealth is bad and causes much of the world's suffering, and wealth is good and God wants you to prosper and be rich. Dr. Richards exposes these myths and other common misconceptions about capitalism and reveals the surprising ways that capitalism is, in fact, the best system to respond to the biblical mandate of alleviating poverty and protecting the environment. Money, Greed, and God: Why Capitalism is the Solution and Not the Problem equips readers to take practical steps in their own lives to conduct business, worship God, and serve others without falling into the prosperity gospel trap. To order Money, Greed, and God, call 888-7000-274 or go online to our secure website 24 hours a day at www.equip.org. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by the Christian Research Institute, a ministry supported solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters.
The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching graphics with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what you'll find in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Should Christians attend same-sex weddings? Would saying yes signal an endorsement? Would saying no signal a lack of commitment to the loved one? There are no easy answers. Other topics include confronting the apologetic challenges of a secular culture, reflections on the girl with the dragon tattoo, sci-fi, free will, and the problem of evil, Muhammad and the Messiah, comparing the central figures of Islam and Christianity, what has poetry to do with evangelism, robbing Paul to pay Peter and James, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Attacks against the Bible's authenticity are everywhere in today's culture. So take the key proofs of scriptural authority with you wherever you go. Hank Hanegraaff's flip chart, Maps, Memorable Keys to the Bible's Divine Inspiration, condenses the proof points from his landmark book, Has God Spoken? In a convenient pocket size, printed on heavy laminated paper for years of use. Good for refreshing your own memory or sharing with skeptics and seekers, the flip chart is our gift to you when you support the Bible Answer Man broadcast today. The Christian Research Institute's vital outreach is entirely supported by God's provision through friends like you, so your gift helps bring you more of the answers you need. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org today to give and request your copy of MAPS, Memorable Keys to the Bible's Divine Inspiration.